I'm just letting it run, Ziggy. I'm letting it run. We might be playing music on this radio station by some point.
We can take requests, can't we?
Yeah, we could. Let's go. You know what, Mon? You come up with the day. 30 years. Requests. We're turning this back 30 years. Classic hits, Key 590. If you're old enough to remember Key 590, then you're my age.
I will say this, though. There could be a sports element to it, because there are certain rinks in different sports arenas where you go and you can say, you know what? They always play that at a Leafs game.
Sports anthems.
Yeah. That's what we should do.
So, and I'm just going to raise my hand here as the leader of the pack of those who have no life. And I guess none of us really have a life right now because we're all staying home if we're being responsible.
You shouldn't have a life. Now it's okay not to have a life.
Yes. Like, finally, after 40 years on this planet, people are realizing what it is to be me. I say that only partially kiddingly. So Saturday night, I'm sitting around, naturally. I'm like, you know what I'll do? I'm going to turn on the TV here. I want to see what Sportsnet has on in place of the usual hockey that it would be airing if this was a normal night. Because Saturday night would have been the second to last Saturday of this regular season. Like we would be into the final week now of the NHL season. We would be sitting here, Ziggy, freaking out over the Leafs because my prediction would have come true, which is that the Leafs would have been in a dogfight right until the end. And we would have been on high alert. We would have been on high stress right now, but we're not. And sure enough, Sportsnet, and you love it too, because there's the bars with the Sportsnet logo on either side, because standard definition television.
It's so old.
On high definition TV. Sportsnet plays game 7 of the 2004 Eastern Conference first round, the Leafs beating the Senators. And that's where Patrick Laliem decided to try to Tony Fernandez a couple of Joe Nieuwendyk shots in the first period there, going his backhand into the hole, and Nieuwendyk scored a couple of goals. The Leafs ended up beating the Senators 4-1 and advancing. Then, of course, they would play Philadelphia, and they would lose in the second round of the playoffs. It's so strange, though, because as I'm watching part of that first period, and I'm enjoying it, and I love seeing the old faces, Pat Quinn behind the bench, Ed Belfour in goal. I even thought wistfully for a moment of Aki Berg. Aki Berg was on that team.
Yeah.
The Great Eight. Not Ovechkin. The Great Eight. Aki Berg.
Thomas Caberle.
Of course, Caberle. Brian McCabe stood up Marian Hossa in a one-on-one. Hossa was rushing with the puck, and McCabe stood him up and knocked him down. I can't remember the last time I saw a play like that in this day and age. But it didn't hit me, and it should have, because you and I have talked about this a bunch of times. It didn't hit me until about halfway through the first period that was the last time the Maple Leafs won a playoff series. That game 7, that night, almost 16 years ago, Ziggy, was the last time the Maple Leafs won a playoff series. And you say, well, okay, that sounds bad enough. Remember, I'm alone on my couch with nothing to do. Nothing but my thoughts. Nothing but my addled brain to tell me stories. And you start saying, well, how old was I and what was I doing at that time? If it's mid-April, late April of 2004, I am 2 months to my 25th birthday. I'm now 40, which means that the Maple Leafs didn't win a playoff series in the back half of my 20s. And the entire decade of my 30s, they didn't win a playoff series.
Yeah,
that's a lot of a person's life.
2013 was the last. I think it was.
They didn't win a playoff series.
They didn't go to the playoffs from then until
until 2013 shortened 13, season.
Yeah,
and the first time they went to the playoffs in a full season was Austin's and Mitch's rookie year of, I want to get this right, 16-17.
Okay.
Because Washington was 16-17. The losses to Boston were in the spring of 18 and 19. So I've got that right. So 16-17. So from 03-04 to 16, 17, everything in between, they didn't make the playoffs in a full season.
I remember Matt's. I mean, Matt's was a beast. But he didn't play the whole playoffs, right? Him and Neuendijk, did they get injured? Like, that's what I'm trying to remember back to that series.
Well, remember
that year's playoffs.
Was Sundin not in that seventh game?
Sundin and Neuendijk, I remember them being out. They didn't play the whole...
Okay, well, Neuendijk was in that game because he scored the two awful goals in the first period on Patrick Laleem. You love those camera shots of John Muckler, the Senators GM at the time, up in the suite after Laleem had allowed those two goals. But so Neuendijk played in that game. The Sundin year that I remember him missing was 2002. Remember in 2002, they went to the Eastern Conference Final, ended up losing to Carolina. But they had that bloodbath first-round series against the Islanders. It was a seven-gamer that was a homer series. The home team won every game. And then they got smoked by the Senators in game one of the second-round series. Because the Senators had cleared their first-round series. I think it was Philadelphia, doesn't matter anyway. But they'd beaten whoever they played rather easily. Five games, something like that. The Leafs had played that seven-game bloodbath. Senators, I think, smoked the Leafs at the ACC 5-0 in game one. And the Senators on paper were the much better team by 2002, and everybody thought it was going to be a cakewalk. I remember I was a kid, young guy, starting my radio career up in Ottawa. Like, I remember what people up there were saying. Like, this is going to be the year where we finally slay the Leafs.
Did it not feel the same way that we feel about Boston right now? Like, Ottawa just could not beat Toronto.
Yes,
in
but
the
difference is, Ziggy, is that you can't make a clear-cut argument that Boston and the Leafs are too different on paper. They're different teams.
You know what I mean, though?
But the Senators were clearly better than the Leafs on paper, in my opinion, just with the young talent they had. I don't want to take anything away from Sundin or Roberts or Tucker or any of those guys, but I think it was in the back end. But I think you could make the argument with Chara, with Wade Redden still in his prime at the time, with a young Marian Hossa up front and Daniel Alfredson. Marty Havlat was a really good player for them.
Chris Neal. Was he not?
Yeah, Chris Neal, but he was always kind of a third liner at best, but probably fourth liner.
Very effective.
But Mike Fisher was a tough, had some skill, tough player. So they had a good young group, and they were having winning seasons. And
well, they'd just gone to the Stanley Cup Final what 2 years earlier or 1 year earlier. When did Ottawa?
They didn't go to low seven.
Okay, after.
Yeah, they went much later. But they, in 2003, they went to Game 7 of the Eastern Final.
Eastern Conference Final.
That's the year the Flyers got the Leafs.
The year before. 2 years before.
Yeah, so, there were 4 out of 5 years that the Leafs and Senators played in the playoffs.
Yeah.
00, 01, 02, and 04. So the Senators went deep in 2003 because they didn't run into the Maple Leafs. That's what I like to say, because the Leafs got waxed in the, I want to say it was the first round that year, by Philadelphia. But so, I mean, I see what you're saying, but I don't look at the Maple Leafs' current roster and think that it is exceedingly better than Boston's. Whereas I thought the Senators on paper were the better team than the Maple Leafs back then.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I just, when I think of Ottawa and Toronto during that time, it was just an organization that couldn't get over Toronto, and they just couldn't beat them no matter what. And I understand that this Boston lineup that the Leafs have been facing last couple of years would be better if you wanted to compare the Ottawa-Toronto back from the 02s, 03s, 04s. What year was it that the Senators lost? Was it Jersey? They lost in the conference finals?
In 2003.
Yeah.
And that was the year Pat Burns went on to beat Mike Babcock's Anaheim Mighty Ducks in the Stanley Cup final. Pat Burns, head coach of the Devils, beat Mike Babcock's Anaheim Mighty Ducks in the Cup final.
Because I went to that Jersey game. I was at one of those games. It did go seven.
Yes, it did. Oh, yeah. It did.
So I was at
Jeff Friesen had a huge goal for the Devils in the seventh game.
Yeah, I was at game seven. It was in Ottawa, I believe.
Yeah, it absolutely was. But the Senators were down 3-2 going to Jersey in game six. Chris Phillips scored in overtime to get the series back to Ottawa.
I just remember watching it. It was my second pro year, and the hockey was great. You know, sometimes you get in the playoffs and it's just another boring 2-1 game, or you know what I mean? Oh, you know what I mean? You know, some series are, they don't really have the bite once you get deep in.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredible hockey. And then to go and watch it live, it was, you know, had been a while since I had a chance to actually, I played in the league that year, played whatever 25, 30 games, and then to get to see what it was like for playoff hockey was interesting.
Yeah, it just felt so weird to be sitting there Saturday night, Ziggy, and realizing, oh my God, Jacques Martin's last game behind the Senators bench was 16 years ago. Patrick Laliem's last game in goal for the Senators was 16 years ago. The Maple Leafs' last playoff series victory was 16 years ago. Yeah. It's just like the latest cudgel or mallet to a Leafs fan's skull. All the crap we've taken, oh, you know, it's been 53 years now since they last hoisted a Stanley Cup. And quite frankly, I mean, if you're our age, whether it's 53 years, whether it's 120 years, whether it's 270 years, it doesn't matter. We've never seen it. So people who always say, well, the Leafs have the largest drought. Well, the drought's not relevant for me. If you haven't seen your team win the Stanley Cup, it doesn't matter. It's like a 25-year-old Habs fan telling me, well, the Leafs haven't won a cup in 53 years. Well, you're 25 years old. You don't remember 1993. I mean, you've never seen your team win the Stanley Cup.
I find it interesting, depending on what era you grew up in, is what your expectations are of your team, right? I remember the team not doing well in the 80s and then being really well in the early 90s. And if it's a good year, it's a good year. If it's a bad year, it doesn't bother me as, say, some fans of some certain teams where it's like, I'm used to winning and now I want to win every year. Like if you're a Bruins fan in the last, 10 years, you expect the Bruins to win or have a chance of it every single year. And then it's hard once you don't get it. So depending on when you grew up, I mean, it was 12 years for the Leafs till they went to the playoffs. So that's a lot of years. If you're a fan of this team, that's just not what you expect, but you become okay with it almost. Or it's like, oh.
Or when they're good, you're like, holy crap, this actually is possible.
Yeah.
Like I remember the 92-93 run as a 13, almost 14-year-old. I'd never seen a good Leafs team. I think Ken Reggett stood on his head in a playoff series in the spring of 86. So I'm 6 going on 7 at that point. And the Leafs went into the second round. But the Norris division sucked. And if you got through the Norris division, you knew you had the Oilers waiting for you in the Campbell Conference final. Like, what's the point even? Mm-hmm. Like, the Oilers would take a best of 7 and beat you in 2.5 games. I mean, there was just, like, nobody had any designs on that Leafs team going to the Stanley Cup. It was just nice that they had an upset and advanced. The first time they were legitimately something, and we didn't even believe it in the first round, Ziggy. But the first year they were legitimately something was 92-93 in my lifetime. And we all assumed, if you go back, we all assumed that the Red Wings were going to crush them, especially after the first two games.
You have to get through the first round. If you look at historically, it's like that first round is usually the toughest. Some teams, you look at them in the first round, and when they're playing and you think they have no chance of winning the cup on in any team. It's like you get past that first round, you get rolling, you have a little bit of momentum. It changes your team. That's why how many times do you go to the conference final or even the finals, how many of them do they sweep in 4? Are they 4-1? It's like by that time, these series are over. Some teams are, you know what I mean? They're run out of steam. You see that a lot. I know the 93-94 Leafs are, you know, you go to 3 game 7s. I mean, that was just, that's tough by the time you get to the conference final. If you're going through that, some teams also, you'll see them run through a team where it's just so tough in the series before where they have nothing left.
You make You make a good point. Do you remember in the mid to late 90s? So we got that epic 7-game Stanley Cup final between the Rangers and the Canucks in 1994. And that was the first time the Rangers had won a cup in 54 years. I want to say since 1940, that was a huge story. But the following year, Jacques Lemaire's Devils swept the Red Wings in the cup final. The following year, and we're now into 96, Colorado swept the Florida Panthers in the Stanley Cup final. Uwe Krupp from the blue line in overtime of game four, Colorado hoisted the cup at the old barn in downtown Miami where the rink should be today. Would help with the crowds. The following year, Detroit swept Eric Lindros's Flyers in the Stanley Cup final. And the following year, Detroit swept Ron Wilson's Washington Capitals in the Stanley Cup's final.
It happens a lot. People don't realize if you actually look it up, it happens quite often.
And it wasn't until Dallas played Buffalo in the finals of 1999 where there was a series that went more than four games. And of course, that was the Brett Hall foot in the crease controversial goal that clinched game six for Dallas in Buffalo. So yeah, there were four straight Stanley Cup finals through the mid to late 90s that were sweeps.
Yeah, very rare do you get it. Rangers, LA, that was a sweep, was it not? Four straight? 4-1. I mean, you can keep looking. If you look at the last 20 years, you're going to see a lot of sweeps, a lot of 4-1s. It's just once you get to the Stanley Cup finals, it's tough, right? There's some teams that don't deserve to be there. You don't think they're going to get there. They go through the battle of those first three rounds, and then you finally see someone from the other conference you don't get to see too often, and it's like as soon as the one team smells blood, it's over.
Does talent usually win the day? Because that's always what people say, right? If you have more talent than the other team, as long as the compete level is the same, the talent will emerge. I know injuries and other things can play unexpected factors in a series. But by rights, if you are supremely talented relative to your opponent, you should, the deeper you go into the playoffs, you should win the day.
I feel like once you get into the playoffs, it's the culture you've built, the system you've built in your team, the accountability is kind of what wins. You know, skill will help you, win the odd game. But when you're winning series, when you're winning championships, it's the culture and your DNA and what everyone, when you see your leaders and what they do to set the bar and everybody follows, that's what kind of wins. That's the big secret to success. And when you see teams that, make deep runs and you see the same teams go over 10, like who knows what the St. Louis Blues were going to do this year. They're just a team that, I mean, they've got some skill, but no one saw what they were going to do last year. No one saw them coming back. And even, I mean, people picked them to have the most disappointing follow-up to their Stanley Cup win, right, this year. And they're right at the top again. So it's when you have that, when you have a DNA makeup, you stick to your systems, you're an accountable team. That's what wins at the end of the day.
The Blues, I was just thinking of last year, I thought there is nothing worse for Mike Yeo than what happened with St. Louis last year, right? He gets fired. Craig Berube comes in. They turn it around in the second half of the season and they storm to the Stanley Cup final. Like he was already on his second turn, right? Because he'd been the head coach in Minnesota before that. So if you're a couple of teams through in the NHL and you're looking for that third opportunity, but a team will say, you took a team to the worst record in the league in the first half of the season. You get crap canned. And they not only turn it around to make the playoffs, they end up winning the Stanley Cup. Like whether it's fair or not to Mike Yeo, I'd put money down that he's never a head coach in the NHL again.
Well, he is assistant coach.
Well, I'm not saying he's not going to be on a bench.
I played for him in Pittsburgh.
I'd just be stunned if he was a head coach again.
He was our assistant coach in Pittsburgh when we won in 09.
Good dude?
Great guy.
Okay.
Like, great guy. Really smart. Will he ever be head coach? I think he will get another crack. I know it looks bad. Happened to Michael Therrien in 09.
Right.
He was there till
January? The next game. Yeah. And then.
And then Dan Bylsma comes in and you win. We saw it in Pittsburgh again with Mike Sullivan a couple years later.
That's right.
He comes in halfway through. So we have seen it in the past. It's hard to, I mean, I remember even when it happened in 09 to Therrien, everyone said he'll never coach again because it looks so bad, right? Like you're saying with Yo in St. Louis, like what could be a worse situation for a coach? But I always knew Michael Therrien would come back to coach and, you know, smart hockey guy and
intense.
Intense is motivating.
Oh, yeah.
Practices are very intense when I play them.
Like long or just get you in short bursts, 45 minutes to an hour intensity.
Oh, I meant like one-on-one individual meetings. Oh, good. Very, very intense.
I'd love to sit in a meeting and just have Michel Therrien
talk at me. But he was fair and he kept you accountable and it didn't matter who you were. So you respect that as a player. Whether you didn't like the way he handled certain guys in certain situations is one thing. But when you're fair and you treat everybody somewhat the same, obviously guys have longer leashes than others, but you respect that as a player.
What was way back, he was coaching Montreal and they played Boston in a playoff series. And there was some incident involving Bruins defenseman Kyle McLaren and Habs forward. I think it was Richard Zednik. And they weren't happy. They felt Kyle McLaren had cheap shotted Zednik. And after the game, Therrien's at the podium and a reporter asked if there would be any retaliation or retribution in the next game. We see for next game.
Yeah, he was.
He was. And of course, lost in a little bit of the English-French translation. I know, but
he gets heated.
Yes.
He gets very heated. So I could see him saying something like that. But yeah, he used to get heated on the bench too. Anybody cheap shot, he had no problem, you know, saying something to another player on the other team. If you were pretty dirty and you're running around a little bit, even if it was a former player, I think I remember Colby Armstrong. I think he was like running around in Atlanta, I believe, too. And Therrien would like talk to him during the play.
Next time we get Colby on.
Yeah, we got to ask him.
Messages from Michel Therrien.
Yeah, we see.
We see for next game. When are we going to have Colby Armstrong on? We see for next show. Jam-packed guests this morning. Stephen Brunt will be along at 7:10. We're coming up on a pretty big boxing anniversary, March the 29th, 1966. So we actually hit it yesterday, today being March the 30th. Glad I know that. It was 54 years ago yesterday that Muhammad Ali fought George Shuvalo. Stephen Brunt has written a documentary for the National Film Board in the past about this match. It was at Maple Leaf Gardens. I'm envisioning a smoke-filled Maple Leaf Gardens and people just glued to this. It would have been epic. We'll talk to that talk to Stephen Brunt about that. Ian Leggett on where golf is right now through the COVID crisis. Should you go out and play? I mean, you can physically distance yourself, can't you, from a playing partner or from three others in a foursome? Could you actually pull that off? What does Ian think? We'll ask him. John Paul Morosi and a former Leaf, now a Belleville Senators defenseman, Frankie Corrado, later in the show. We got to Burl the lead, though. Hugh Burl is in the studio. We'll do it next. Good to see you and hear your voice, Hugh Burl.
It's good to be seen and heard.
So let's discuss the issues in the sports world today. Okay. I'll start with the first question.
Sure.
Do you like stuff?
I like some stuff, yeah.
Stuff.
Other stuff I'm not enamored with, but most stuff, yeah.
Most stuff?
I have an affinity for most stuff, yeah.
We haven't thrown the poll question out on Twitter, so we'll do that. People who think pro sports will be returning by some point in May are ... hopeful/on the right track. Delusional. Those are your two options. At Scotty Mac thinks, at Mike Zigamanis, at Hugh W. Burl.
I already voted.
Are you one of the 83% who said delusional?
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes, I am. May's a little bit early.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Hopefully mid-June.
I am not even the guy you want to be talking to if you're looking for optimism on this. Yeah. I think the stuff that's going to come from that silliness in spring break a couple of weeks ago.
See a little bit of that now. There was over 200 new cases in Ontario announced yesterday.
But I'm talking we need the United States to get its act together if we're going to get our sports back, right? Most of the teams are based there.
Yeah.
And I just am not, I don't have any expertise. I don't have any knowledge. I don't have inside dirt. We can't predict any of this. I'm just not optimistic.
They did the tracker of people leaving spring break in Florida and like going back and how, where they went in the U.S.
Yeah.
And it just like filtered into everywhere.
If you were stupid enough to go to Florida and be around hundreds of people at once, you're stupid enough to go home and see your parents or your grandparents or your friends. And you're infecting, if you're sick, you're infecting them, and then they're seeing people. That's the problem here, right, is my point.
And it you're not giving the virus time to die off. You keep passing it around and passing it around. Stay home. All right, we're good?
Well, you answered the stuff question appropriately, so.
Time to get off
the soapbox. So what stuff do you have for us, you?
Well, Scott. We're all starving for sports these days. Not a lot happening out there right now. Yeah, duh. Golf is a sport that's perfect for isolation. That's why I play it. But Golf Canada CEO Lawrence Applebaum is advising holding off on teeing it up for now and follow the lead of pros and just stay at home. But what about this? Interesting yesterday on Twitter. Phil Mickelson responded on Twitter yesterday to a fan who suggested that, and I'm quoting here, do you guys think there's a chance that you and Tiger go play around mic'd up with one camera guy and just put it out there on a stream for people to watch? We need live sports. Surprisingly, Mickelson responded by saying, working on it. And then less than 10 minutes after that, Mickelson appeared to double down by saying, I don't tease. I'm kind of a sure thing. Leading to speculation that, yeah, we might see this again. Lefty and Tiger battled it out at Shadow Creek in Vegas, which is Ziggy's favorite course, back in November of 2018. Mickelson won the $9 million prize. So, a couple of things here. Should they do it, and would you be interested in seeing it again?
Yeah, of course.
Did you see the first one?
I wouldn't have watched the whole thing, but... I remember.
I bought the pay-per-view.
I remember the Duval Woods matches, the heads up.
Yeah.
You remember those? Those were, I believe they were like a Monday night series back then, but those were awesome.
Yeah. And they had like things like Battle at Bighorn, that kind of stuff too. But that they had Annika Sorenstam participate in that. It was almost like an exhibition golf thing, which was great. But
what courses are going to be even open right now? Like who's maintaining their courses? That's the next question, right?
Yeah.
Because aren't courses shutting down?
Yeah, I just think maintenance is doable though, right? You could assign one worker or even two workers to each hole.
Yeah.
If you wanted to, and they could maintain it or however it is you would do it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if there was a sport out there that could do something like this, it would be golf, right? I mean, with one camera person, you know, streaming this live, so there's only three people on course, you probably could do it.
I'm thinking of how to generate revenue off of this. It would obviously be of interest. Would you do it via the pay-per-view route the way that they did a couple of years ago? Because I'm wondering what corporate advertising budgets would be given what we're going through. And If I'm Phil and I'm Tiger and I do this, I'd want to generate enough revenue and then just disperse it to
a bunch of places
that, yeah, I mean, that they don't need the money.
No. And Phil Mickelson winning, what, another $9 million? No. Well, I mean, you got Tiger Woods as TaylorMade and Phil is Callaway, so maybe they could jump on board. But by the way, Ian Leggett joins Leadoff this morning at 7:30. He'll have thoughts on this. Lego will, for sure. So when baseball comes back, I don't know, whenever that is.
Well, it'll come back in 2021 at the latest, you think?
What's your gut tell you about the season? Is there going to be a baseball season?
Well, Hugh, I'm not the guy to come to if you're looking for optimism on this.
I'm honest. What's your gut tell you?
Well, my gut says the United States is a complete and total tinderbox and everybody's brought accelerant and matches to the party. That's where I'm at right now. I think Canada's doing pretty well with this, is my sense.
I think so, yeah. I mean, there are a few pockets here and there of people, you know, like still congregating at parks.
Never going to bat 1,000.
Yep.
I mean, there are morons among us, but not in this room.
Well,
but there are morons among us.
And
in the United States, I mean, they got 10 times the population. Some people are in denial about it. And
so you're not optimistic about a baseball season. What about you, Zig?
I feel like the season is going to happen. What I'm confused is that there are some people that cover the sport that aren't going to be happy or don't think there should be an 80 or 100 game season, which I was a little shocked. Like, isn't 100 or 80 games better than
nothing? You mean
they'd want
the entire season?
Yeah,
they'd
want.
I don't think there's any way you could do an entire season.
They want more games and they want to go till Christmas.
You're talking like Scott Boras, the power agent, saying, hey, we should play through the fall and into the early part of the winter. And
over the Christmas holidays.
And we'll play our playoff games in neutral sites. Like, obviously, the Minnesota Twins, who have an outdoor stadium, cannot host baseball games in December in Minneapolis. I mean, good God.
No. Yeah, they're not going to have a full season.
Could you imagine the Twins outdrawing the Rays in a neutral site World Series game at Tropicrappa Field down in St. Petersburg?
Well,
could you imagine?
When baseball comes back, whenever that is, there will be lots for Blue Jays fans to be excited about. Lots of great young talent. We all know about Bo, Vladdy, Cavett, and Lourdes. But there's also a lot of hype about hard-throwing Nate Pearson. Former Jays pitcher Pat Henken is among those who can't wait to see Pearson throwing smoke.
I mean, one, he's a hard worker, and two, his misses are good. And what I mean by that is he's not buckshot with his fastball. He tries to throw a ball away to the right. He stays on that side. He keeps the ball in his lane pretty good for a young pitcher. And on top of that, he's got a nice delivery. He's got a good tempo, really good delivery. He gets good load on the backside. And, we're really excited as an organization. I mean, I think MLB is excited to see this guy perform and compete at that level.
So Henken's just like us. He really wants to see Nate Pearson pitch, and he's a spectacularly hard-throwing pitcher.
If Nate Pearson had a last name, I'm trying to think, if he was Nate Clemens, if he was Nate Halliday, if he was Nate Martinez, like Pedro's son, would he be getting the hype that Vladdy Jr. got?
Ooh, yeah.
Because
I think he would.
Like, Vladdy was a dominant player wherever he went. He was just kind of a baseball machine, right? His father's son and his uncle Wilton took care of him through his youth and taught him how to play the sport. Like, Nate Pearson, if he had the lineage, and threw 103, 104 miles an hour with that father or with that grandfather or both, having played in Major League Baseball, we'd be like, oh my God, it's the next one. I think Nate Pearson health is everything.
Yep.
And we know the elbows and the shoulders, especially when you throw that hard that often, can take a lot of wear and tear. But if this guy stays healthy, I think this is going to be a lot of fun for lot of years.
You think he's the real deal here?
Well, and it's not, like people say, who was the last homegrown hyped pitcher the Blue Jays had like Nate Pearson? And I think the answer to that question is there wasn't one. Like, Dave Steeb was drafted as an outfielder who was then turned into a pitcher in the minor leagues.
Where'd Stroman come from?
Stroman was a draft pick out of Duke University, but I don't think he had the hype.
No.
Sanchez didn't. Nobody was like, oh my God, Marcus Stroman throws 102 type thing. Chris Carpenter and Roy Halladay were obviously highly thought of and both went on to have great careers. Roy in particular, Hall of Famer. But before it all started, I mean, we're looking back on all those guys with hindsight. Before it all started, nobody went, holy crap, the way that people say holy crap about Nate Pearson,
yeah,
because of how hard he throws.
There's still something about 100 miles an hour, and there's something even more about 104 miles an
hour. And there's something even more about a guy who insists that maybe one day he could get it to 110.
Oh,
and I'm like, I have no idea how you're going to do that.
Can you just rely on that and nothing else?
No, he's got to have, if he has a wipeout slider to go with that fastball, that'll curl some hair, man. Like he could be a real dominant pitcher at the top of a rotation.
Well, just like the rest of us, Tom Brady's watching a lot of TV these days, and that included a replay of Super Bowl 51 yesterday. Patriots and Falcons, you know, the one where the Pats trailed 28-3. Fox Sports aired it one day after, 3-28. That's very clever. Brady went on Instagram to voice his displeasure with Tom Brady, posted a screen grab of the 21-3 halftime score with a bunch of angry face emojis. Then later, with a picture of the score 28-3, Brady posted, "Why am I nervous?" We all know how it ended. 34-28, Pats the final in overtime. That is some solid trolling by Brady. We also saw how emotional Jimmy Johnson was when he found out on live TV that he'd been elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He cried. Troy Aikman cried while watching it. Johnson has announced that his former quarterback will be the one to induct him this year. Johnson's two Dallas Super Bowl titles were won with Aikman under center, not owner Jerry Jones. Jerry Jones will not be inducting Jimmy Johnson. Johnson, by the way, still not in the Cowboys Ring of Honor, despite all the success he had there. But Jones says, well, Tom Landry went into the Hall of Fame first before going up to the Ring of Honor, so we're going to do the same thing with Jimmy Johnson.
I see.
Yeah.
That makes either sense. That or 25 years later, the bridge still has not been repaired after it was burned.
Yeah.
That was not pretty.
No, that was not an amicable divorce.
No, and of course, at that point, that's when Jerry Jones started to fancy himself a general manager rather than just an owner, and would often clash with Jimmy Johnson. Barry Switzer, who, I mean, he had some success at Oklahoma.
Yep.
University of Oklahoma. Yep. But he was just kind of like this. I always look at a guy like, if he had the success he did in Dallas and never was a head coach again.
Yeah.
Like,
well, that was Jimmy Johnson's team.
Yeah,
that
dude was just
there.
A yokel. Yeah. I mean, it was Jimmy Johnson's team. That was a great weekend, by the way, because the day before, Bill Cowher found out the same way.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about Bill Cowher's history, great run with the Steelers. His wife, his first wife, he's remarried, but his first wife passed away, right, of cancer and stuff. So I can't imagine what would have been going through his mind. That was, I know it was showy, but it was a real cool way to get Cowher and Johnson into the hall, finding out, like, here, have a reaction on live TV.
Yeah, and those were real emotions. Like, to see guys like the big, tough football guys, to see them break down, it means so much to them. The Hall of Fame is the absolute pinnacle of sport.
And we got some of our Blue Ball and Sports Hate out on Friday when we talked about athletes we loved in spite of hating their teams. Troy Aikman is on that list for me. I always liked Troy Aikman. I hated who he played for, and I hated that he beat my Niners so much, but I always respected him.
I like him more now as a broadcaster. I could not stand that guy when he played.
Because you hated the Dallas Cowboys.
I had to.
You and your Washington saw them twice a year. Stephen Brunn, Ian Leggett in the 7 o'clock hour, John Paul Morosi, and former Leaf, now Belleville Senators defenseman Frankie Corrado in the 8 o'clock hour. The phone lines are open right now at 416-870-0590. We like to give away Untuckit gift cards. We got $100 worth today. Call in now to be the contestant when we play All or Nothing next. Right, this is our brand new game we play every weekday morning at this time, where you need to be either really good or really bad to win it all. And we call it All or Nothing. Like the name says, you need to get all of it right or none of it right to win. Three true or false questions, how you fare on that first question, whether you get it correct or incorrect, determines what you need to do with the next two questions. Simple enough. For $100 in Untuckit gift cards. Good morning to Dwayne, our contestant. Hello, Dwayne.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me, guys.
Happy to have you.
Yeah, great to have you on. All right, first question. James Dolan, owner of the New York Knicks, has tested positive for the coronavirus. He is the first pro sports owner to test positive. True or false?
I'm going to go with true.
Yeah, that is correct. He is 64 and experiencing little to no symptoms and is self-isolating.
I'm sure Charles Oakley is just brokenhearted over it. Dwayne, so you got to get the next two questions intentionally correct.
Let's do it.
All right, Dwayne, let's do it. Like you said, Raptors superfan Nav Bhatia was called the most annoying fan to play in front of by LeBron James. True or false?
False.
Yes. Very nice. All right, Dwayne. You are not that far removed from a couple of really nice shirts. The pressure is on. You've got to get this intentionally correct. Here's the question. Jimmy Johnson was elected to the Football Hall of Fame in January, and for the ceremony, he selected one of his former players to introduce him, and that player is Troy Aikman. True or false?
Well, I'm going to have to guess on this one, and I'm going to say true.
Yeah! Ah! Congratulations, Dwayne. $100 in Untuckit gift cards coming your way.
Those were three tough questions.
Three tough questions. Although, Dwayne, I don't know. Is Dwayne a friend of the show? Because Hugh mentioned Troy Aikman. We'll be introducing Jimmy Johnson and Burl the lead. So maybe Dwayne just now got into his car. Mm. I'm sensing some hurt feelings over there, Ziggy. The thought that Dwayne might have just tuned in and missed the last segment.
It happens.
It happens. Congratulations, Dwayne. $100. So we'll do it again tomorrow at this time. $100 to Untuckit will be on the line when we play All or Nothing. John Paul Morosi at the top of the 8 o'clock hour. It was, I guess, middle of last week that baseball and its players union agreed to some stipulations for the return of baseball, or in the case that baseball doesn't return the 2020 season, this will have an effect on the Blue Jays. No doubt about it, specifically as it pertains to service time. Vladdy Jr., Bo Bichette, the young kids, Kevin Biggio, they will all get a year of service time, whether a game is played or not, this season. And if a half season is played, they'll apportion it out properly. We'll get into all of that with John Paul Morosi. Frankie Corrado, now a Belleville Senators defenseman, former Maple Leafs defenseman. What's life like as a Maple Leaf for Frankie? We'll see if he wants to do a deep dive into that conversation with us. Ian Leggett on what golfers should be doing through the COVID pandemic. And up next, Stephen Brunt. It was 54 years ago yesterday that Muhammad Ali and George Shuvalo fought for the first of what ultimately would be two times. The bout took place at Maple Leaf Gardens. Stephen Brunt has in the past written a documentary for the National Film Board about this match. We will relive it with Stephen. And in advance of that conversation, Ziggy, Hugh, and I will give you our top three boxers of all time. We do that next. And that's Elton John, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, Classic Hits, Key 590. Oh, I wish we had video. I wish we had streaming right now.
I love Elton John's one of my favorites.
Grooving. Yes.
I've seen him a couple times live. And very entertaining. Sounds exactly like when it's on in your car.
This was from the Living Room Concert for America last night. We played Dave Grohl, My Hero, the Foo Fighters song from the late 90s, about an hour ago. We'll see what Ryan Mon comes up with as the show goes on. Stephen Brunt, in just a few minutes, our poll question today, and you can get us on Twitter at Scotty Mac Thinks, at Mike Zigamanis, at Hugh W. Burrell. People who think pro sports will be returning by some point in May are ... hopeful / on the right track, or delusional. We've got 225 votes, and 85% are saying delusional, to which I respond, what's going on with the other 15%? I don't think there's any chance pro sports are back at any point in May. And I hate to say it. I just think that the worm has not even begun to turn, especially south of the border, with this virus. And unlike another idiot from New York, we can sit here this morning and say for sure that James Dolan does not believe COVID-19 is a hoax.
Not anymore.
The Knicks owner testing positive, although he is asymptomatic, just like the Knicks record most years. Asymptomatic.
Oof. It's cruel but fair.
Imagine that. Imagine if his caretakers were like Chuck Oakley and Spike Lee.
It's not going to happen.
Nurse Charles and Nurse Spike taking care of James Dolan.
But maybe after this he comes back as a kinder, gentler human being. No.
Maybe he'll own the Knicks in the same way he owns the Rangers, which is to not be involved, more or less.
People are all over him on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It was a little too much. It was a little much on Twitter yesterday. People were like, oh, thank goodness.
Kicking him when he's down.
Yeah, like...
The not well-wishing, you mean?
Yeah, the opposite? A little overboard.
Well, nobody's wishing the worst on anybody. Well, people on Twitter are.
It was bad.
People have wished us the worst. Do you know what I did, by the way? All weekend long, I was telling Hugh before
it's a great idea, the show, by the way.
9:05 Friday morning, I deleted the Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook apps off my phone, and I only put them back on at 5 o'clock this morning as I was having my breakfast. I was social media free for almost 3 full days, and my mood, I'm not making this up, my mood was so much happier. So much happier. And it wasn't just like, because you see the stuff on Twitter, like, oh, this or oh, people arguing back and forth. It's just like, it's like subliminal misery.
It's freeing in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, well, plus you've got to invent other things to do. Oh, I
like connecting with people through social media.
You know what you find? You know what, though, Ziggy? When you're not connecting with the entire universe, you're more likely to connect with the people in your life, because you're not overstimulated by all the faux conversations you're having in the ether. That's my lecture for your Monday morning.
Well, I'm not having a conversation with anyone right now. Who am I seeing?
You're seeing us, too.
At home.
You a little insulted?
Ziggy and I are having a conversation right now, and he says I'm not having a conversion with anybody
well,
right
now. Well, you know now. What I mean. I mean
Hugh?
At home.
Hugh?
I've never
you
been,
have this conversation.
I've never been more insulted in my life.
Apparently, I'm not here.
Well, when you're at home, I mean, Who's there? I mean, I don't have anyone there, so I'm on social media.
Play a little Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Call a friend.
Mm-hmm. I do just FaceTime some friends. But
call
it's not
a friend. Just reconnect.
I played poker with the Zoom app with some buddies on Friday night. That was cool. I won.
You're
not bragging, but I won.
You might not. You might
played
not.
Played poker. I would love to know how that one works.
No, the Poker Stars app, and then you just fire up Zoom in the corner.
See, Hugh might get this. You're gonna laugh, and it doesn't involve me, although I wish it did. My brother was telling me. I FaceTimed my brother, sister-in-law, nephew, niece yesterday, and my brother was telling me that a couple of nights ago, he and about 10 of his high school pals Zoomed. This Zoom thing is like a lifesaver for everybody. Zoomed, and they watched the 1996 Royal Rumble together. WWF at the time. WWE. You wrestling losers. So I guess they just all Zoomed and like were able to see each other's faces, and they watched this 25-year-old wrestling pay-per-view together. The internets. Yeah.
I like wrestling, just for the record. So everyone knows.
Were you getting some hate on Twitter?
No, but you trying to chirp me again about wrestling. One time I said I let it slip that it was fake, and I've never lived it down.
Well, I just think
I get it that it's predetermined results. I just find it funny of the people that are cheering for different wrestlers in the stadium when it's already determined.
Okay, well, you are never allowed to watch a movie again and invest in a character. Cheer for a character,
I've never done that, though, in a movie. I've never cheered for a character.
So you don't watch Batman and see Batman versus Joker and cheer for one side or the other?
I get out of my seat and put my hand in the air for a character in a movie.
Could you picture?
No, don't do that.
Ziggy with a Batman or Joker foam finger in a movie theater?
Oh, Batman! It's the same
Jack
thing.
Napier's my boy!
It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
Yeah, well, it's peer pressure. It's peer pressure, right? Stephen Brunt, in just a few minutes. These are uncertain times for us all, but many Canadians, including children, face the fear of not knowing how, where, or even if they will get their next meal. With the economic impact of COVID-19 deepening, food banks across Canada are concerned about not having enough food to meet demand. Many food banks only have enough food for the next 2 weeks. So it's time for us to step up to the plate and donate the best way we can. And the best way to help is by donating money at foodbankscanada.ca. Foodbankscanada.ca. If you have a little bit of extra cash lying around, please donate at foodbankscanada.ca. Ranking our top three boxers of all time before Stephen Brunt joins us in just a few minutes here to discuss yesterday's 54th anniversary of the first of what would be two boxing matches between the legendary Muhammad Ali and the legendary Canadian boxer George Shivalo took place at Maple Leaf Gardens. Hugh, who do you have?
Well, it's pretty hard to go against the great Muhammad Ali.
So he's my number one,
yeah,
too.
He would come in number one, I think, on most people's.
Yeah, Ziggy's got him, too.
I'm number one, yeah. Muhammad Ali.
But yes. After that, it becomes very, very subjective. I mean, a lot of guys here, like Jack Johnson, maybe. What about any one of Hearns, Hagler, Duran, Sugar Ray Leonard in their heyday? But I'm going to go, in terms of top, I'm going to go with Mike Tyson, number two, only because, to me, I watched most of his career, and he was the most dominant boxer. He was the most dominant boxer I'd ever seen. I mean, he had his fights won long before he ever stepped into the ring. And number three, I don't like the guy as a human being, but he's arguably the greatest defensive boxer in the history of the sport. So for me, number three is Floyd Mayweather Jr.
Okay, well, this is going to be awfully boring because I agree with you completely. I'll take it from a different perspective on the Tyson thing. Tyson was dominant when I was a kid. And so my background is not strong in boxing. I acknowledge that. And I think that that is relatively normal for somebody of my generation. But Mike Tyson is one of those guys who, not always for the right reasons, nope. So I'll be very clear about that, but is one of those guys who transcended his sport. Muhammad Ali is my one, as
absolutely.
I said, and he transcended his sport for the right reasons. And Floyd Mayweather is my third, only because his nickname is Money. And has he had the best competition relative to generations prior to his? That's certainly arguable. But who's made more money? Who's cashed in on his talent better than Floyd Mayweather? And the answer is probably nobody. Who do you have, Ziggy, as your two and your three beneath Muhammad Ali?
How about no one that's on this list? How about like a Sugar Ray Robinson, who was 128-1, I believe.
Wow.
And would you consider him a middleweight, a lightweight?
Yeah, he's certainly not a heavyweight at all. But yeah.
So he's on there. I mean, George Shivalo from Toronto. I mean, how can you? I know he's not the name, but since he's from Toronto, I'm going to give him a shout out. Somebody who we were talking about before, who else is not on this list?
Lennox Lewis.
Lennox Lewis has given me his money a couple times playing poker in Jamaica.
Ooh, wow.
I've gotten to play poker with him a couple times, and he is almost as bad as Hugh at poker.
Oh! Shots fired.
Hugh?
We'll see.
Invite Lennox Lewis into your next Zoom poker game. Next time you get together with the boys.
Yeah,
there you go. All right, Stephen Brunt, one of the co-hosts of Writer's Block, 1-4 here on Sportsnet 590. The Fan is with us now to relive the Ali Shuvalo match from 54 years ago yesterday. It was the first of the two matches that they would have. Why don't you chime in, though, Stephen, before we get to that? Who are your top three boxers of all time?
Yeah, I was just listening to you guys. What are the criteria here?
The criteria is whatever you feel the criteria would be. Because for me, like, Tyson was impactful when I was a boy. He transcended the sport, not always for the right reasons, but he was the name. Floyd Mayweather, you just can't argue with his bank account if that's how you weight it. So Muhammad Ali is my one for obvious reasons. Tyson and Mayweather are my two and my three. I'm not saying they're the best three of all time, but that's how I rank them.
Yeah, it's tricky because, you know, I can limit it to people I've actually seen, you know, in my lifetime or people who I didn't. You know, like Ray Robinson is generally regarded as the greatest fighter who ever lived as a welterweight. You know, he never lost as a welterweight, and he fought way too long, and he lost a bunch of fights late in his career as a middleweight. But as a welterweight, he was but there's almost, never mind not seeing him in the flesh, there's almost no film record of him as a welterweight. So it's hard, but, you know, kind of in terms of his technical ability, most boxing people would put him at one. You know, so you can mine history for guys like that. And I got to tell you, like, the technically, in terms of skill, the best fighter I've ever seen is Floyd Mayweather, period. You know, just because of what he can do in the ring. There's nobody in my lifetime who is as good, whether you like him or not, and he's not a good person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but if we're gonna knock good people, you know, if it's about good people, that's going to be a much shorter list in boxing. But, you know, in terms of cultural impact, which is a different category, you know, Ali for sure, obviously, you know, because he's made an impact in so many different levels. And Ali pre-exile, you know, a guy who was that big and that fast and that skillful. You know, Ali, after he came back, is a different fighter. And he showed a lot of courage and a lot of smarts and a lot of guile. But the guy who, you know, was forced out of the ring in 1967, if you look those fights, 66, 60, 65, 66, 67, well, you know, that guy has never, ever been seen in the world, a guy that big who could do what he could do. And, you know, I covered Tyson's entire career. I saw him when I saw his ninth pro fight. I interviewed him for the first time when he was 18. I saw him in the ring live 25 times, I think, you know, in good times and bad. And, you know, he was kind of exposed. Well, he was exposed first by Buster Douglas and then by Evander Holyfield.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of a crossover, as you mentioned, as a guy who crossed over into the larger culture, yeah, he is the last guy, really. Like, look, you know, the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight was a big deal. And, you know, even in its own way, the Mayweather-McGregor fight culturally was a big deal. But Tyson was the last boxer that had that kind of, you know, kind of cartoon character status with the public. You know, and he was incredibly dominant for a stretch until somebody figured that if you punched him back, you had a shot with him. So, in terms of covering a guy, yeah, I think the guy you mentioned, a guy who doesn't get rated highly enough, is Lennox. And, you know, he had two bad losses, you know, to Oliver McCall and Haseem Rahman. You know, both fights, he got knocked out twice, and, you know, he avenged both those losses. But those are kind of blights on his record. But if you look at the rest of it, a guy his size with his skills, he would have given any heavyweight in history a really, really tough night, and he would have beaten most of them. You know, like it's almost not a fair comparison, but guys like, you know, Rocky Marciano were tiny compared to him. You know, guys who fought at under 200 pounds. You know, Lennox was 250, and with that skill set, yeah, he would have just toyed with some of those smaller guys.
Stephen Brunt with us, the co-host of Writer's Block, 1-4 here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So let's set up March the 29th, 1966. George Shuvalo, at that point, going into his first of what would ultimately be two matches with Muhammad Ali, has a professional record of 34 wins, 11 defeats, and two draws. At that point, I mean, he's obviously a well-known figure, Stephen, but at that point, heading into the Ali match, and I think George is best remembered for those two epic matches with Muhammad Ali, so they haven't happened yet. Who is George Shivalo in the Canadian lexicon at that moment?
Well, you know, to be honest, he's already 10 years into his career at that point. You know, he's turned pro in 56. So, you know, and he turned pro as kind of a local hero, a guy who fought at Maple Leaf Gardens a ton, you know, promoted by Deacon Allen. But by then, he's kind of a fallen local hero in a lot of ways. You know, he has lost a bunch of fights. He's known for being kind of a tough, like the toughest guy in the world. You know, he never knocked down, fought a lot of top heavyweights, but he lost to almost all of them. You know, he really did. So he's a kind of a middle of the pack contender, sometimes in the top 10 in the world, and you know, kind of the old Ring magazine rating, sometimes not. And he gets that fight not because there's an overwhelming demand. Like the backstory of that fight is amazing, because you know, Ali had been run out of the United States, was not allowed to fight in the United States because of his refusal to enter the draft for the Vietnam War. And he was supposed to fight a guy named Ernie Terrell, who held one of the heavyweight titles from Chicago. Again, a guy who was kind of a perpetual top 10 guy. And he was supposed to fight Terrell in a bunch of different jurisdictions, and they kept running out. The fight kept getting canceled. The various commissions and politicians in various states said, no, you can't, Ali can't fight here. So the fight eventually landed in Toronto, you know, because Harold Ballard, who was running the gardens at that point, was willing to do it for money. And I know that's shocking. You know, and as a sideline, a little sideline to that, Conn Smythe, you know, the man who built the gardens, and a veteran of two wars, and you know, look, Conn Smythe there's some things that are not that admirable about Conn Smythe too, but Conn Smythe never set foot in the gardens again after that fight because they let a quote draft dodger unquote fight in his building. So that's the fight ended up there. It was going to be Ali Terrell at Maple Leaf Gardens, and then Terrell pulled out at the last second. And, you know, there are a lot of theories about why that happened. Terrell was a mobbed-up guy. There's a lot of stuff going on with Terrell. So the fight was in limbo, and it was the first promotion for Bob Arum, who became a very big deal, still out there in the boxing world. Jim Brown, the football player, was his financial partner. This thing was hanging by a thread, and they needed an opponent. It was 17 days out, and that's how Shivalo got the fight, because he was here, because he was in shape. George was always in shape. They thought he might sell some tickets as a local, so they threw George in there on 17 days notice, and the fight still didn't sell out. You know, it's kind of one of the weird parts of this thing is that it's, you know, it played in three quarters full, I guess, Maple Leaf Gardens, but it became bigger in legend, it became bigger after the fact than it was in the moment.
Ali said he's the toughest guy I ever fought. Did that change people's perception of him or change his legacy, the fact that someone of that stature had those kind of words for Shivalo?
I think, you know, it's funny, Ali did say that about other people too, so just okay, to be accurate, you know, Ali occasionally said that about other people. And you know, he won 13 of the 15 rounds in Toronto, maybe 12 of the 15 rounds. But he couldn't stop George. Like, no one could stop George. No one could knock George out. And, you know, if you watch that fight in the 15th round, Ali, you know, really does go out and try, does everything he can, just unloads on him. And, you know, George takes a step forward. He never takes a step back. And I think that it's kind of George's courage. Now, you know, again, George's reputation, he was not a darling in the local, you know, the local sports writers carved him in those days. They made, you know, they were cruel about him. But I think surviving that fight and, you know, doing it nobly, and I think that, you know, if you kind of talk about the myth of George Shivalo in Canada, because you know, he is a guy, every, you know, if you're Canadian, you know the name. And, you know, people know that he fought Ali. They probably don't really know what happened in that fight. But that the idea of the toughest man in Canada, you know, a guy who is indomitable, and of course, you know, in his own life, that became a factor later on, because Lord knows he took a lot of shots in his personal life later on. the myth of George was really born that night in a lot of ways.
With Stephen Brunt, one of the co-hosts of Writer's Block, 1-4 here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Just a couple more minutes, Stephen. Muhammad Ali, is he the most important and influential athlete to this point in the history of North American professional sports?
Yes. It's easy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not even close.
Because of, you know, the times and how in some ways he shaped the times because of the decisions he made, because of his conversion to the Nation of Islam, because his refusal. You know, and again, there's a lot of side stories about his refusal to enter the draft and, you know, how fully formed his political and philosophical position was in those early days. And, you know, but the fact is he didn't have to do that. And there were ways out. There were a bunch of outs that he could have taken that would have allowed him to continue to box and make millions and millions of dollars. And he refused them, you know, and he lost the prime three years of his career. And there's a bunch of things you can say about Ali. There are a million things to be said about Ali, but in terms of a guy willing to sacrifice financially and personally for a cause, at a turbulent time when the position he took in 1965, 66, you know, people turned against the war later, but they had not turned against the war at that point. It was an incredibly unpopular position to take, and he was, you know, part of a fringe religion, and he stuck by his guns, and that, you know, it's hard to find people who would sacrifice a nickel for a point of principle anymore. You know, or use their fame, you know, to make the world a better place, or to fight for a cause. And, you know, he was an international icon, the most famous human being in the world, and he decided to use that platform, you know, for a particular reason, not just to sell shoes to people, which subsequent athletes might have done.
Right, and I'm thinking, trying to compare to someone today, and it. Probably is an understatement to say it's not a fair comparison, but like I've always advocated for what Colin Kaepernick has decided to do here, Stephen. But obviously, I mean, he's getting paid by Nike, even though he's been blackballed by the NFL, and so is Kaepernick at all in the Ali vein, or did Muhammad Ali help to lay the groundwork for someone like Colin Kaepernick who can still find means of significant income despite being blackballed by the league where he gained his notoriety?
Yeah, and I think, look, I'm not saying that Ali, if, you know, there'd been money from Nike for Ali in the 60s, that he wouldn't have taken it. You know,
sure.
He went out and boxed exhibitions and did speaking tours. He tried to feed himself and feed his family in those days, but I think Kaepernick sees himself that way for sure. You know, I think he's actually, I think he's dressed himself up in Ali theme stuff occasionally. You know, he's kind of wrapped himself in that flag. But and I'm fine with that, because he did give, you know, well, he's been blackballed now, but blacklisted. But he did, you know, he would still be making NFL money in some form had he not chosen to take a knee. That is an act of principle. You know, you can agree with him or disagree with him. That's fine. But you cannot disagree with the fact that he sacrificed in order to espouse something that he believed in. So, yeah, there's the, you know, but it, there are no real comparables for Ali. You know, that's in all ways, you know, what he meant culturally, in that very, I say that very, very volatile moment when he chose to step up and say, no, I'm not going to go.
Yeah, and Ali probably has a 100% approval rating today, but that obviously was not the case.
That's the thing that people miss, and right. it's important, is that, yeah, he became a benign, beloved figure later on, you know, especially when he got sick. He was safe, you know, around the time of the Atlanta Olympics. Everybody loved Ali. More people hated Ali than loved him then. Mm. Way more people. It was a dangerous decision to take. And yeah, the kind of smile, the, you know, the silent Buddha figure of later years doesn't really do justice to how dangerous he was in that moment.
It's a great way to leave it. Thanks, Stephen. We'll do it again next Monday. Appreciate the historical context.
All right, see you guys.
Stephen Brunt, one of the co-hosts alongside Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch of Writer's Block, 1-4 here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, you know, view into what that fight that happened so many years ago, and you hear the stories, right? But I mean, Brunt knows he's better than anyone.
He's written
on
the doc on it.
Yeah,
he's written
the doc. It's pretty special that you know, we get his insight.
Ian Leggett, should you be golfing socially distant, physically distant this summer?
This was going to be my golfing summer.
This was going to be the summer of Ziggy. Will he have to put the driver away? We'll ask Ian Leggett next. So this was supposed to be the summer of Ziggy.
Essential Ziggy.
Essential Ziggy on that golf course.
I haven't played much last 4 or 5 years, but I was going to make it this summer. And I've said the last couple, I was like, you know what? I'm going to get in my 50, 60, maybe 70 rounds.
Well, you're in a good spot to do that if you're able to, right? Because you're off work at 9:01 in the morning.
And I can go to the, play, you know, 11 to 3 and then got the rest of my day.
What's your handicap? You good? Are you good? I'm not a good golfer, so I'm not going to sink you on this one.
I haven't kept an official handicap the last couple of years, just not playing enough, but in and around 6.
So you'll
closer
shoot
to 4 if I'm playing.
So good day for you is high 70s.
Yeah.
Low 80s. 70,
no, around par, above par, under 80, yeah.
Okay, so you can play.
I'm okay.
Good as a kid? Like when did get really good at it?
Yeah, I know. I was given clubs for used clubs as a kid early. Yeah. Like 8, 9. I got an early start on golf. Golf was the big, I started with a golf and tennis camp as a kid and just picked both of those sports up.
There you go.
So those were my summer when I wasn't playing.
Team sport athlete in the winter and individual sport in the summer. I like it.
Yeah.
And a great way, obviously, to get out. We're just not sure if we're going to be able to do that this summer. And to discuss that further, Ian Leggett joins us, Sportsnet's golf analyst. Ian, it's great to get you on. We appreciate you doing this. Are you, because as we think about golf, I mean, some people say, well, you can go out and you can play around by yourself. Well, that certainly would be physically distancing. You could also get out in a twosome or a foursome and stay at least 6 feet apart. Drive your own carts around or walk the course, remain physically distant. You don't have to touch the flagpole, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are ways to do this. Don't pick up the rakes, or maybe there aren't even rakes in bunkers. Would you advocate for the continuation of golf through the spring and the summer, given our temporary new world?
Yeah, you know what? I've had a lot of time to think about it, obviously, as a lot of people have in, you know, sort of our world right now, because it's one of those unusual phenomenons that's happening. And, you know, with social distancing, there is that potential to do that in the game of golf. And the issue that I have with it is, you know, I am strictly, you know, asking people not to play the game of golf. And the term that they're coming up with, it's less safe. You know, it's, you know, you've got that ability to go out there and do exactly what you said. But the problem is, are people actually doing it? The other issue we have is we aren't 100% sure who's actually carrying the virus. Now, if a guy shows up to the golf course and, you know, his eyes are puffy, he's coughing, he's got a runny nose, he's got all these symptoms that are very visual, are visible to everybody around him, then obviously we can control it. The other thing, if a person shows up with a card that he's tested negative to it, he's now, you know, been quarantined, he's got all the factors there that people are not doing right now, as we're very well aware of. People are posting pictures on social media yesterday of all the people out at parks and walking around, sitting at benches, walking, you know, close to each other at the beaches and things like that yesterday on our first, you know, beautiful day that we could get outside. And people aren't doing it there, and we're expecting golfers to do it. So I think that the risks are way too high to be in a position to say that it's okay to go to golf right now, but it's not okay for a restaurant owner to say, well, what I'm going to do is just open up every other table in my restaurant and my staff are going to be fully covered, like you're, you know, going to visit the hospital and we're going to stay open while they're closed. I think the issue is that we can't trust people to actually be following the guidelines of social distancing and everything that goes around with touching stuff on the golf course to protect everybody around us.
Well, yeah, it's one thing if you're going to play with someone and say they make it from a foursome, they say two players max, but to actually have a golf course operational, you're going to have staff next to each other. You might have grounds crew next to each other when they're, you know, back wherever off the course. I don't understand how these courses are going to be able to separate people. And is that an essential service when you're going to have workers at a golf club come in close contact with either the players or each other?
Yeah. And as of right now, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that have the virus and can't even tell you how they got it. They can't tell you that, yes, I was working in the cubicle next to the person that was, tested positive 2 weeks ago, and then I tested positive. I'm sure that has happened, but the percentages of people that have the virus now have come in contact with people that they had no idea where it was coming from, and that is the reason why we're in this position now. People allude this to, the flu. We always know who has the flu. Mm-hmm. If you contract it and you find out 3 days before that you got it, well, then obviously you know where the flu came from. We don't know where people are getting this from. We get all of a sudden, like you said, a twosome go off, and this is what we're going to mandate. We're only allowing twosomes every 30 minutes. And then all of a sudden, one of my staff gets sick.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know where that person came from. We find out that, a week earlier that one of the members was out at the golf course and he contracted it and came out because he wasn't showing any symptoms at the time. So I think there's way too many variables where we're putting people out that are in public when the only way that we're being told right now to eradicate this is to stay inside and stay away from people, period.
And
if people could do that, I think we're going to put ourselves in a much quicker position to get back to the game of golf.
Do you have a sense of what the private courses are going to do in Ontario? Because I know New Brunswick and Quebec are closing all recreational facilities, right? And that, which includes closing down private golf courses. Do you think some of the courses around the GTA will open up regardless of what's done by the province or the government?
No, I think they're going to be mandated to close, no different than the provinces that you're mentioning. I think that it'll get to that point for sure. I think the government will step in and just claim that these are not essential services as they already have. And that, there's a timeline on that, as we know. But I think that timeline will continue to get extended until we have control of what's going on here. But I think the beautiful part of this compared to any other sport that's out there, and if there is such a thing as a silver lining in all this, the game, unfortunately, there will be some, damage along the way where golf courses will not be able to survive this. But golf is the one sport that people are going to come back to. When the doors open up to the freedom of being able to go outside and being able to interact with people again, golf will be the one sport that people come back to. People getting together on a soccer field or, playing baseball together or whatever. I think it's going to take a little bit of time for people to get back to this. It was interesting. I was talking to a friend the other day and he says, it's weird when I'm watching television or something right now and I see two guys on TV in a movie or whatever shaking hands or hugging each other. What has happened to us all of a sudden when we're terrified to even have social interaction now? But I think with the game of golf, we're going to be able to get back to some form of normalcy much quicker through the game. But we need to set aside for now and let's let this thing figure itself out before we actually start getting into a position of interacting with people.
Ian Leggett is our guest, Sportsnet's golf analyst, and we're talking about golf in the COVID-19 pandemic. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. The PGA Tour, Ian, and they're going to do it differently for the top 150 players in the world and then for 151 on downward. But the tour has come up with a way to ensure that players and caddies are covered, are relatively financially secure through this period of time. And I would imagine, quite obviously, that money is less of a concern for the top players in the world than for the guys who are grinding it out, trying to maintain their cards or earn their cards as the seasons go on. Are you, based on what we've learned about how the PGA Tour plans to apportion this out, are you satisfied with how it is approaching sort of those lesser names, those guys who are fighting it out week after week?
I think that's just the nature of the PGA Tour. You know, when you look at it, you know, you, even though this is much different than sort of eat what you kill type of thing, which is much different than any other sport out there where there's no, you know, contracts. You know, sure, the top players in the world and will have endorsement deals that are quite astronomical. But for the most part, the PGA Tour is about if you perform well, you make the most amount of money. So I hope, in my hope, that we're going to see some great stories out of this. And you're going to see those guys that are getting those $100,000 checks that don't need them necessarily, donating them.
Right.
Giving that money back. And that's the nature of the PGA Tour. The amount of money that is raised through the game of golf, not only on the PGA Tour, at other levels. And it's heartbreaking for me when I look at it right now and we look at the amount of charities that rely on golf through our golf season to raise money for their, you know, specific charities that are not going to happen this year. So it's incredibly important right now for all of us to, if we have that ability, to start giving back in some way, shape, or form to keep those, you know, associations and groups somewhat surviving through this time. But my hope is that the tour players are going to get together and a guy, you know, like Tiger Woods and guys like Tommy Fleetwood and guys like that, that $100,000 isn't going to matter to them, that they're just going to ask the tour, you know, give it to, you know, the Florida Food Bank or give it to whatever, you know, type of charity to keep them sustainable during this time. But it's unfortunate. You're right. There's guys on the Corn Ferry Tour. There's guys on the McKenzie Tour this year that, you know, inevitably is going to be delayed at some way, sometime as well. That aren't going to have an income. There's guys on the Corn Ferry Tour that are giving lessons online so that they can just keep themselves somewhat afloat at this time because there's no revenue stream for guys like that that normally may take a job at a restaurant or something to get ready for the season to have enough cash to get going. So everybody is feeling this. It's from the, you know, the guy that, you know, the day-to-day worker to guys in our business, you know, at Sportsnet, we see it. We see everybody is, this is impacting everybody. The sad part of this, again, that this, what's happening with this pandemic, it does not discriminate. We see wealthy people, we're seeing athletes, we're seeing, you know, people that need a paycheck day-to-day being affected by this. And, you know, where this ends up at when we come out of this thing, nobody knows. But the thing we need to do is be conscious enough to be safe and take care of each other when we can.
Thank you so much for this morning, Lego. Really appreciate it. And as golf news crops up through the COVID pandemic and then beyond, of course, we'll be turning to you. Appreciate your time.
All right, guys, be safe.
Ian Leggett, Sportsnet's golf analyst.
I believe he's one of the founding members at Beacon Hall Country Club, where I've played a many dozen of rounds.
A many dozen. How many a many dozen?
A lot.
I thought, see, because I didn't know, as you were midway through that sentence, I thought maybe you were appealing to Lego's kindness. Get me to Beacon Hill here.
Well, if we had some more time, I was going to say, hey, how about
start buttering them up a little bit?
How about taking the boys out for a round somewhere nice?
Okay, so I'll make this promise to you. If you want to do this, when we're allowed to go golfing and life gets kind of sort of back to normal, we'll go and we'll play around. But here's your trade-off for me. You're not allowed to talk about what you see on the radio. You're not allowed to talk about the quality of my golf game.
Can't bring it up.
On the radio. It is absolutely off base. It is offside. You cannot discuss anything you see. Anything you see didn't happen. It's like
one
a trip
thing.
To Vegas.
One.
It's like a trip to Vegas.
How about one?
You have. What are you going to pick your favorite worm burner? Is that what it's going? You get to pick your favorite worm burner.
Well, you're going to do something ridiculous on the golf course. I already know.
Or the 2 foot putt that somehow ends up 10 feet away on the other side.
I get
of
to
the
bring
hole.
Up one thing that
one thing
that bothers me during the round that you're going to do. Etiquette wise,
you know what? I like that better. The thing that bothers you because my bad shots they're too numerous to count.
Well, I can already
if I
imagine.
Screw up, I am by the book, man. I'm not here to screw around on a golf course. I can't play golf, I'm not here to cheat to make myself look better.
I'll play a round of golf with you, but I'm not looking for your golf ball. That's my one rule.
Oh, trust me, I'm not looking for my golf ball either.
Okay, so we're gonna go, you know what? We're gonna go to a Muni, and we're gonna go to Tam O'Shanter Golf Course in Scarborough.
Sounds good.
Okay.
This isn't some like
unless somebody else
Tiddly par three where you're...
Unless somebody else that's listening wants to host us.
Yes. I should just warn you, if you're going to volunteer for this,
Beacon Hall,
I am part of the package.
The National Golf Club of Canada.
Yeah.
Hamilton Country Club.
You are inviting somebody who can create divots with his driver off the tee. That's the only hint I'm going to give you.
I'll repair all of Scott's divots.
All right. So that's what Ziggy will be doing for the day. Frankie Corrado, a former Maple Leafs defenseman, now playing in the AHL for the Senators farm team in Belleville. He will be along at 8:35 to talk about his experience playing for the Maple Leafs. And when he was with the Leafs, there wasn't a lot of playing being done. John Paul Morosi, Sportsnet's MLB analyst, also with the MLB Network, on the agreement reached last week between the league and its players on what will happen service time-wise and other issues-wise in the event that there's a partial 2020 season or not a 2020 season at all. It's all ahead. John Paul Morosi, Frankie Corrado, coming up next hour on this day in sports history, March 30th, 1918. The Toronto Arenas beat the Vancouver Millionaires for a 3-2 series win, the first ever playoff series in NHL history. Mike Zigomanis had a goal and two helpers in that game. That was a good response right there. I like that.
18.
Dragged that one out. 1918, 102 years ago. In 1976, the Philadelphia Flyers became the first NHL team to win 13 games in a month. That's got to have been, and I'm always dangerous when you go off the top of your head, but that's got to have been the year, Ziggy, where they went almost 30 games without a loss. Pat Quinn might have been the coach of that team. Have to go back and look, because Pat Quinn was the head coach of that Flyers team that went on that epic undefeated run. But we will go back and look to clarify that. 1981, the Indiana Hoosiers win the NCAA March Madness tourney. Isaiah Thomas, future Detroit Pistons great, future Toronto Raptors executive, was the MVP. And in 2003, we always throw this in for you, WrestleMania 19 at Safeco Field in Seattle, which is not on our lineup. So you're saying, how do you know that, Scott? It's just because I know. It's just because I know.
You know everything.
Brock Lesnar beat Kurt Angle for the WWE title 17 years ago today. By the way, Wednesday, April the 1st, 2 days from now, 30th anniversary of WrestleMania 6 at Skydome. 30 years. That was a major card. We might do a little historical review of that wrestling card on Wednesday, Ziggy. So buckle up.
Can't wait.
Get to reading. Get your research done. There will be a test afterwards. Frankie Corrado and John Paul Morosi. Will the Blue Jays, I mean, this one hurts a little bit. I'm glad for the players, but it hurts the Blue Jays. If there's no season in 2020, the Bobichets, The Vladdy Guerreros, the Kevin Biggios of the world, they'll get their full year of service time. That's one less year of control without any baseball for the Blue Jays. We'll discuss with John Paul Morosi next. I really want to get to the chorus here. Yeah. This is Green Day, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, Classic Hits, Key 590. I'm going back to the Key 590 reference every hour. Every hour.
I posted a little song on Instagram stories last week. Oasis, Wonderwall.
Yeah?
I might do a Green Day this week.
You're inspired.
Well, I put the stay home emoji. Everyone's kind of posting stuff.
Sure.
And it's just to entertain. And I had
that's a way to stay connected.
I had 1,000 people making fun of me. But, you know, I'm not great, but it's fun, right?
Well, but you're...
yeah.
We are entertained. But you got to... It's a way to stay connected, and it's a way to express creativity in a really weird time. Howie Mandel was on TikTok dancing with himself.
That was funny.
Against the mirror.
The salsa.
And
he called it
the pirouette and all
salsa
that.
Distancing. Funny.
I liked it. So, yeah, we're all coming up with different ways. And by the way, it's not social distancing anymore. It's physical distancing, which I think is an even better description because it actually tells us what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to stay physically distant. Because with social distancing, Ziggy, you know this. You can be in the same room as somebody, but being totally antisocial, whereas you can also be 1,000 miles away from somebody and being totally social.
Okay.
So we'll call it physical distancing. Now, we're physically distant. Here we're 6 feet apart.
We're far away from each other.
You're not sneezing and you're not coughing, so you have nothing to blame me for yet.
No, don't make me put the mask on.
No. Well, it's a good look. We'd be posting that. Hugh Burrell is jumping in. Is there breaking news?
There is, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
I got new Olympic dates for you.
You got new Olympic dates?
Yeah. The opening ceremonies next July 23rd.
2021,
and the closing ceremonies August 8th. So July 23rd to August 8th of next year.
Okay, so that's the same as it would have been this year,
pretty
right? Because the 24th to the 9th, so same dates.
Yep.
Starts on a day and ends on the same day of the week as it would have last year. Thank you for that. Hugh Burrell with the breaking news. The Tokyo 2020 games will be in 2021, July 23rd to August 8th. So that's we all are. That was from last week. Who said that? Mom's got to get my...
Yeah,
Michael Bublé. That's right.
So, no, it's... No, that's good that they have the dates. And I've also heard for NBA that if they come back, they're going to do a tournament either in Vegas or Bahamas and then start the regular season right after. Just a rumor. And if they don't come back this year...
Sorry, what? They're going to hand out the Larry O.B.?
They're going to come back to a tournament style, some special tournament style they're going to have to come back to figure out who goes to the playoffs and then run the playoffs right away.
And then they're going to start next season? Well, that's so the teams that are out of the playoffs or out of this tournament are going to be holding training camps?
That's the rumor. And then if the season does not come back this year, they're just going to do like a charity event, 1 or 2 day event.
All right. Well, John Paul Morosi has been patiently waiting while we ruminate on many things. He is Sportsnet's MLB analyst, works for MLB Network and Fox south of the border. It's been 7 days since we saw you. How much traction, John, do you think I can get out of bringing you on each and every Monday morning and making some joke about how many games the Red Wings lost since we last chatted? Or do I just need to shelve that now?
I tell you what, guys, and good morning. It gives me a good sense of normalcy. It makes me feel like we're still in the rhythm of the hockey season. So by that measure, you can make all the Red Wings jokes that you want. Get those jokes in now.
Okay.
Because I do have full faith in Stevie Y that a few years from now, things will be a lot better in
Detroit. So what year were you born?
1982.
So your earliest memories would have been late 80s, because when I was born in 79, John. So, and I'm telling you, the Leafs were in the very same boat, Norris Division with the Red Wings. Our two teams stunk in the 80s. So your earliest memories, are they of the Red Wings stinking, or had they turned the corner by that point?
So I really started to dial into hockey sort of the later 80s, like 87, 88, 89. So right when the Wings were encountering the Oilers in the playoffs and not able to get past them. That was my first understanding of the infamous Goose Looney's issue. That was one of my first hockey fan memories of a playoff run was when that playoff run ended right there at Edmonton. But I have very few memories of the Wings being bad. It was basically as they were becoming relevant, at least those that stay with me now. I had almost no memories of the Red Wings being out of the playoffs in my entire life until the last couple of years.
Well, that's... See, I grew up in the 80s.
It's been a charmed existence, I can assure you of that.
It has, yeah. It's really weird. It's like the Blue Jays. I started following them in 85, and I didn't know what it was like to have a bad Blue Jays team until, 94 they were under 500 when the strike began, but 95 was really that first year. I was 15, 16 years old, where it's like, holy crap, they actually could be poor. It's definitely a psychological adjustment. So last week, and this was after we talked, it was midweek last week, the league and the Players Association in Major League Baseball struck an agreement on the stipulations for a return in 2020 and or should the entire season get banged here. And I still think that is still on the table, John, because we just don't know where things are at with this virus. Would you describe it as a win for the owners, a win for the players, or a saw-off such that it's a win-win-ish for both?
I think there were aspects of the deal that were very good for both sides. I think first and foremost, the players, I think the biggest win of all was probably that they were able to earn the right to free agency for players who had 1 year left, even if there was no 2020 season. So Mookie Betts, JT Realmuto, Trevor Bauer, that they can all become free agents this fall, even if there's no season. That's a pretty big win. And also the fact that MLB is not enacting the force majeure clause that would allow them to not pay anybody because it's a national emergency in the U.S. I think that's another big win for the players. So they're getting the figure that Jeff Passan's reported that MLB is going to pay out a combined $170 million in salaries in this early portion of the season, even without games or without new revenue coming in, is a pretty strong gesture by MLB. And I think, guys, the key takeaway, in addition to that, the financial and service time aspects, is that there is a framework for play to begin. And some conditions that have to be met, that obviously there's no more travel restrictions within the U.S. or bans on mass gatherings. But I also think it's important that as part of the agreement, that if bans or restrictions against gatherings come up during the course of the season once play begins, in other words, hot spots occurring throughout North America, if in fact that occurs in the late summer, that it does not necessarily mean that the season halts altogether, but that perhaps they look at options like neutral site games, games without fans at that point in time. So to me, there is enough flexibility in this agreement that, and obviously I'm not a medical expert, but I'm going to be optimistic that just based on the number of avenues that they've got to get the games in, that I am hopeful, I remain very hopeful that we're going to have baseball in 2020.
Does this stoppage Does it help teams that are trying to rebuild like the Jays? Does it help them in any way that it would maybe not help teams such as, I don't know, Yankees? I don't want to say Houston's would be a bad example. But
you're talking like the Dodgers maybe making the trade for Mookie Betts and then never actually having him take the field if he leaves in free agency type thing.
Yeah, in relative terms, Mike and Scotty, I think that's a good point that this situation from a pure baseball standpoint, just if we're looking at the on-the-field aspect, it probably is a bit more damaging and difficult for teams that believe that they are right on the cusp of winning the World Series, and the Dodgers certainly fit that description. Whereas for teams that are building, it certainly is a period of unscheduled and unwanted rest for someone like a Nate Pearson in Toronto or a Casey Mize with the Tigers, Tarek Skubal, the young prospects the Tigers have pitching wise. So I do think that is one aspect of this, one way to look at it. But eventually, I think for Toronto especially, and to some degree Detroit, because the Tigers are on the upswing a little bit. It's not quite as dramatic as where the Jays are right now. But this is a very important platforming year. This is a very important year to get these guys to the big leagues, to get them some seasoning, and expose them to the competition at this level. So that way 2021, certainly for the Jays, can be a really competitive year. And so missing out on that opportunity is a real detriment, but it's not quite as profound as the Dodgers potentially not having Mookie Betts play for them in 2020.
John Paul Morosi is our guest, Sportsnet's MLB analyst, also with MLB Network and Fox. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Help us understand, John, the arbitration process once a player is eligible. And this is what I mean by this. It's going to hurt the Blue Jays if there's no 2020 season, because Vladdy, Bo, Cavan, Danny Jansen, their younger kids, are going to gain a year of service time, which will push them 1 year closer to arbitration eligibility, and then in the longer term, 1 year closer to free agency eligibility. But does it hurt the player that they lose a season pre-arbitration eligibility? Or is an arbitration figure typically negotiated or argued based off of the most recent season's numbers and performance? Because if it's a whole, like if it's on a 2 or a 3 year thing, your first time arbitration eligibility, you know, losing a season could affect the number you can argue for.
Right. That's an excellent point, Scotty. And here's how I would look at it. Number one, yes, the platform year is always the most important year. And so if you're now a first-time eligible player, which those young players that debuted last year will not be yet, that's still a couple of years in the future. But if a player is coming up on, if this was going to be the first platform year of salary arbitration, so in other words, if this is going to be someone's third year of service, roughly, give or take, then they would revert back to the numbers of the previous year as the new platform year. And very importantly, it was said as a result of these conversations that there will be a lesser emphasis on the counting stats, and Jeff Passan's report on this as well, a lesser emphasis on the counting stats than on the rate stats. So in other words, they're not going to, if there's a half a season, for example, they're not going to say, well, you didn't hit 30 home runs or 40 home runs, but it's going to be based on more your OPS. If there is a half season this year, it's going to be thought more about your percentage stats and the averages than it is you didn't hit X number of wins or innings or home runs, because it's just simply not fair to compare a half season to a whole season in that method. So I think overall the parties have done a very good job of ensuring fairness in comparison across players and eras and the way that those numbers are decided upon. But obviously a lot of these aspects, the draft potentially being shortened to 5 rounds, everything is sliding, everything is being compressed, And it's not a perfect situation, obviously, but I'm encouraged overall and broadly speaking, guys, that there is an atmosphere of collaboration between MLB and the union, which bodes well for the future. But certainly this year, I'm heartened by the way they've communicated that we could still have a very good chance to see baseball here in 2020 if all of us do our parts as citizens with the physical distancing to give our healthcare workers the best chance to save lives.
Next time you're in Toronto, John, I want you in studio for an hour, and we will talk about one subject, Scott Boras. I just want all the goods. I find this guy completely fascinating. Obviously, he is brilliant at what he does. He has been incredibly successful. He has negotiated up for so many of his players. Guys often come to him having relinquished the services of their previous agents to get into the Boras Corporation, all of that. And we hang on this man's every word when he does the lobby thing once a winter at the winter meetings. Waves upon waves of media. He's always got something to say about each market. It's a show. So when he's talking late last week about, well, why don't we play into the winter and we'll play neutral site playoff games for the cold weather markets that play outdoors and can't host games into December. Let's have a World Series game on Christmas Day, for goodness sake. Is there anything to this, or is it just Scott Boras is talking again?
Well, I look forward to that the hour-long Boras conversation. We'll have some good anecdotes back and forth. I think I still somewhere have in my house the Edwin Jackson binder that was put together for Edwin's free agency that got him to the Cubs. I think I still have that somewhere in the house that we're at times I would be able to procure the actual binder that he assembled for some of these free agents, which is quite a sight to behold. But as it pertains to the question about the World Series, first of all, Scott has been a longtime advocate of a neutral site World Series, or at least neutral site games within the World Series. And I think he's actually onto something, because it allows the game to market itself around one site, and you can know months in advance where the games will be, as opposed to the World Series itself, where you're not really sure where it's going to be until 3 days before in some cases. It allows you to market it as you would the Super Bowl, for example, with parties and other galas and other events. But I think the question of how deep can you go, I think, guys, that it's not out of the realm of possibility. You guys were talking, and Mike was mentioning what the NBA could do with different tournaments. Right now, we are in such uncharted territories that you might as well try new things. You might as well try different ideas. And in fact, the idea of November World Series games at a neutral site has been mentioned. Bob Nightingale reported this here recently. So that far has already been somewhat officially discussed. So pushing it into December is not that much of a rhetorical leap for me, and would not surprise me that much. But for the fact that 2021 is a World Baseball Classic year, and so it would be difficult for any pitcher who is involved in the playoffs on any level, if it's in November, December, to turn around and pitch in the Classic. So you may have a different looking World Baseball Classic as a result. But I do think on some level, November World Series games at a neutral site I could see very easily here. And so December, I can't rule it out, because we are simply in an area where the circumstances are without precedent. And we do know this, guys, or at least we believe this based on what some health experts have said, that temperature hopefully does help mitigate against the transmission of the virus on some level. It's not proven, but some experts believe that. So if that's the case, play the games in as warm a climate as you can, and build in enough flexibility as you can, and make sure that the events occur. So by that measure, November, December, World Series games at a neutral site, whether it's Arizona, Florida, California, Texas, guys, I think in the full range of options right now, that is somewhere in the realm of possibility here in 2020.
With John Paul Morosi, last one for you. If things were normal today, we'd be talking. The Blue Jays would be 4-0. The Red Sox would be limping out of town 0-4. Cincinnati would be coming into Toronto for a little interleague play. I'm kidding. I'm sure the Red Sox would have at least gotten one of those four games. But
I'm a believer in the Jays. I don't know. The Jays have won three out of four.
I like it because what is, and this is a Boston question, what is this Red Sox team? Betts is gone. Sale's injured. David Price went to L.A. in the Mookie Betts trade. Rick Porcello signed as a free agent with the New York Mets. What is this Red Sox team this year? Like, give me a win total in a normal season, John. Like, what would you have projected them to be?
That's an excellent question. And this goes back to something that we had touched on a few weeks ago before the world changed, that I think there's a very good chance that the Jays are the third-place team in this division and the Red Sox are fourth. Toronto's got a better roster, and certainly I think the Yankees and Rays have a better roster. So the Red Sox, who in this past decade were kings of boom and bust, finishing first and finishing last in successive seasons at different times and sort of going back and forth. I think for the Red Sox, without Chris Sale, this is a 77-78 win team in a full season. So that means we'll see how many games are played, but I think this is a below 500 Red Sox team. They're going to have to rely a lot on Nathan Eovaldi to bounce back in a big way because you've got no Sale, no Price, no Porcello. The reliability of innings, Eduardo Rodriguez certainly had a watershed season in so many ways last year, but this is not a team with sufficient depth. I think the Rays and Yankees have much better pitching depth, and I think even the Blue Jays do as well with what they've got coming. There is no Nate Pearson on the way right now for the Boston Red Sox, and so an under 500 season in 2020, I believe, is coming for them no matter how many games are played.
We'll do it again next Monday, John. Thank you.
We'll do it again with the requisite Red Wings jokes part of the conversation, as they always are, my friend.
They now have 54 regulation time losses this season and counting. We'll come up with a new number for John on the Red Wings losses this time next week. John Paul Morosi of Sportsnet, or should say Sportsnet's Major League Baseball analyst of MLB Network and of Fox. Frankie Corrado now plays defense for the Belleville Senators. The AHL franchise linked to the Ottawa Senators, of course, when hockey is being played. He played some hockey, kind of, sort of, for the Toronto Maple Leafs. He will join us next to talk about the experience of playing for Toronto. It was unique for him, to say the least. If you're an air guitarist and you're mouthing the words, does that make you an air singer? Because you have done some air singing this morning, Ziggy.
Maybe I'll bring my guitar in one day.
I'll tell you what. We got to save our bullets because we're going weeks and weeks and weeks without sports. So I don't know some of the topics we got to talk about. We got to come up with topics we need to discuss.
Yes.
Before we allow Ziggy to come in and play guitar live on the radio.
All right. Maybe people want me to play.
We need to talk about. We need to talk about our favorite flavors of Kraft dinner. We need to discuss why butter melts.
Flavors of Kraft dinner. There's different flavors.
Well, there's original. There's white cheese.
Original with ketchup.
What else is there?
Strong cheddar. Nothing else. There's nothing else.
Do you cut hot dogs and put them into your Kraft dinner? These are all things we have to debate, discuss, go over before you're allowed to play your guitar on the air. By the way, I got a pause for station identification. That was Oasis, Wonderwall, Classic Hits, Key 590. Back to originally scheduled programming. There you go. You know, this was Key 590 like 30 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we became Sportsnet 590 The Fan. That's the reference I'm making, Ziggy, in case you're
okay.
Looking for a little history of Toronto radio. The federal government is asking if you have a few extra bucks to please donate to reputable Canadian charities as we try to get through this COVID crisis. And as we know, we are in uncertain times. And there are many Canadians, including children, who are facing the fear of not knowing how, where, or even if they will get their next meal. And with the economic effect impact of COVID-19 deepening, food banks across Canada are concerned about not having enough food to meet demand. Many food banks are telling us they only have about 2 weeks worth of food still stored up. So it's time for us, and we will do it here, to step up and donate. And the best way to help donate is by donating money at foodbankscanada.ca, foodbankscanada.ca. So reputable Canadian charities like foodbankscanada.ca could use our help.
360kids.ca, youth homelessness shelter in the York region. Someone I will try to work with throughout the year. They're, you know, if you can donate to them as well right now in the time of need, it's really difficult, right? Because they can't have everyone come in. So they're kind of reaching out and changing their programs because it's hard, right? They have a hub, I guess, in Richmond Hill. And obviously with everything with COVID-19, it's becoming a challenge.
Yeah, so. Wherever your passions lie, please, if you have a few extra dollars kicking around, and some of us are still working, we have that opportunity. Please give where you can, and we certainly will here. We will not tell you to do things that we aren't. We will walk the walk as well as talk the talk. Frankie Corrado is a defenseman for the Belleville Senators, former Toronto Maple Leaf, and a pal of Mike Zygmantas. Is this true, Frank? Are you and Ziggy tight? You friends? Do you tolerate this man?
We're getting there. Yeah, we've spent some time together the last couple seasons, so it's been good to get to know Ziggy.
Yeah, you got to tell them how good of a coach I am at UFT, all those D drills I'm putting you guys through.
Yeah, Ziggy's put me through D drills. I don't think he ever crossed the blue line coming back into his own zone. No, I'm just kidding. It's obviously I got the chance. Well, I was rehabbing a couple injuries over the last couple of years, and UFT was nice enough to have me out to skate with them and practice with them rehabbing. And I, you know, just got to meet Ziggy and the coaching staff there, Medzi and Doves, and just a great group of guys, you know, from them on through the players. And I think you saw the success they had this season, and I think it had all to do with, you know, the great group they've built there and the communication and the camaraderie that they've built.
The guys are really lucky. They got a guy like, you know, Frankie coming down and skate, and they get to see a pro and kind of how he prepares and how he practices. And it helps the team a lot. It helped our defense a lot just to kind of see what NHLers do to get ready. And I think a lot of guys, you know, Frankie, when you come out, and there have been a number of former NHLers that have skated with the team, but it really helps guys and shows them kind of what it takes. Because we had Marty McSorley on the show last week, and I had him with the Kingston Frontenacs, and just giving guys an insight of, you know, what guys do to prepare and how they practice really helps guys.
Yeah, it makes a difference. I mean, I remember during the lockout season, we had Nick Foligno and Derek McKenzie up in Sudbury skating with us, and you know, you always wanted to go against them in drills, and you kind of saw the way they took, you know, all the drills very seriously. And, you know, just the pace that they competed with in practice was different than at the junior level at the time. And, I think it's good. It's good for guys to see that. And you know, you learn a thing or two out there, and it's like, you know, it's like if you're a rookie starting out and there's some older players on the team, you kind of watch them and see what they're doing. So, it was good. It was really fun. It obviously was good for me to be practicing with you guys and help me get back into some game shape.
With Frankie Corrado of the Belleville Senators, former Maple Leafs defenseman on leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So I'm fascinated by this, Frank. You're living this like the rest of us. How are you staying in shape? Are you working out at any kind of level that you'd like to be able to, given that I'd imagine you can't see your trainer, you can't skate with a bunch of guys. You can't do the things you ordinarily would do off season, in season, to stay in shape.
Yeah, so obviously I don't have the luxury of having a, you know, a big home gym that some of the guys you see on Instagram and Twitter have. So I live in a condo, you know, downtown Toronto. So to be honest with you, to take a little bit of time off at this time of year is not the worst thing, because you're just, your body goes through a lot during the season and there's a lot of bumps and bruises. And then me personally, like, I haven't had time to take off in the last 3 seasons because I've, you know, had a major injury that led to rehab, that led to training, that, you know, then I got back into playing. So I haven't been able to take 2 or 3 weeks off at the end of a season for a long time. So as far as working out right now, I'm taking it as a little bit of rest, and, you know, I'll do a little bit of, you know, muscle activation, some foam roll, just something to keep keep the blood flowing. But I think as things kind of get going here and as things progress, I'll get back into it a little bit more. But I think every player is different. And, you know, for me personally, this is a good time to kind of reset and recharge the batteries a little bit, something I haven't been able to do recently.
A lot of the listeners definitely want to know a little bit about your time with the Leafs and what went over that 10-week stretch. And, you know, I get asked a lot to, you know, what's it like sitting out for a month at a time? Because I think I sat out 10-game stretch, which felt like 3 seasons, 1 year in Phoenix. What can you tell us about your time in Toronto, you know, playing here and you know, coming over from Vancouver and then, you know, not really playing your first couple months?
Yeah, that 10 games, that feels like nothing for me. it went from like getting waived in Vancouver was, you know, that was not a great feeling. And when you find out you're getting picked up by Toronto, I mean, that was like the most elated I've ever been. Like, it was crazy. And getting to meet all the guys, like getting to meet Dion and all the players here, guys that I've watched and you know, even played against, it was surreal. It went from like the lowest of lows to the highest of highs. And I really wanted it to work. Obviously it was almost like failure to launch for me. And even, you know, the year that we finished last place, you know, like I think I was playing some good games. I was playing some not great games. And I think the inconsistency is not great, but I think that's still part of, you know, bumps in the road, learning the league a little bit as a defenseman. And then that summer I really was, you know, focused on having, you know, a great summer, putting on some weight and having a great training camp, because I was well aware that, you know, there's probably not a spot waiting for me. I'm probably going to have to earn it. And, I thought I did everything I could that summer, and that next training camp, I thought I had a good camp and, scored a goal in the first game, had a few assists the next game, and, just, you know, tried to compete as hard as I could. And, you know, I ended up sticking around and kind of made the team from there. But, you know, obviously when you carry 8 defensemen, you know, it's hard to get in the lineup, you know, if you're waiting for injuries, and not that you ever, you know, want guys to get hurt or anything like that, but that's kind of the only way you're getting in at that point with 8D. And, you know, it was weird. It's weird to sit out because you don't feel like you're really a part of anything. You're there for fist bumps after mm-hmm. the game and you know, you morning skate, you do your bag skate and whatever it is. And, you go on with your day and go to the rink at 7 o'clock and watch the game. It's weird. You don't really, you're missing that connection almost, you know, with the guys that are out there battling every night. And, that's something you want as a player. You want to be in the heart of it with everyone. And I think that's how you build, you know, your best relationships, you know, even with your teammates.
The social media, I guess, and even former players started to get involved in the Free Corrado kind of campaign. Did that, like, for me, I've had something, I didn't have it as big of a situation as you did, but I had something similar where it was almost like when you're getting that media attention and social media attention, that it can make it worse, where I mean, if you're a coach and you have all this media attention and social media, I guess, pressure, you almost don't want to put the guy in because you don't want to be, you know, you don't want to have a gun to your head and then put a guy in that you maybe you don't want in the lineup. Did you feel any of that kind of outside pressure make the situation worse for you?
I mean, it definitely magnified things. You know, I think there was one game, I finally got in a game in February against the Rangers, and it was like, wow, he's playing, you know? And it was like, there's just way too much attention on an eighth defenseman going into the lineup, in my opinion. You know, it just should be another roster move that you know, kind of gets swept under the rug. But I mean, we're in Toronto, and there's obviously a lot of media presence, and it's a story that kind of was played out for such a long period of time that it's like, hey, like, here's the stage. And oh, by the way, everyone's watching everything you do tonight, you know? So,
yeah.
It's tough. What do you do? Like, that's the market. And that's, you know, that's the world you live in as a player for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And that, you know, you kind of sign up for that, but it, the whole, you know, campaign or whatever you want to call it. I mean, that's not the, ideally, that's not the way you want to be remembered as a player in the city. You'd like to be remembered for, you know, playing and doing some good things on the ice. But, you know, that's like I said, that's something that's just, it's out of your control. And, you know, I just tried to do my best to control the things that I could at the time.
With Frankie Corrado. So you're 27 now, Frank. I mean, you were 23, 24 as you were going through this, still a very young player in the NHL with most of your future ahead of you, and to not be out there, to not play, that can stunt development, that can affect your career, and it must have weighed on you mentally. So when you look back on those days, I understand it. I'm kind of throwing these out there because I don't want these to be your responses. We understand this is a business, and you were making the NHL minimum, which is a lot more money than most people make, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, we're privileged in that way, or you're privileged in that way. I understand it, but it had to take its toll on you mentally. You'd worked so hard to get to that point, and now you're at that point, and you're not even getting a chance to play. Do you look back with any kind of resentment or bitterness, or are you just kind of like, hey, it's how it played out, and I got to make the most of the opportunity I got now?
Yeah, I think I'm probably more prepared for that kind of situation at this age, at 27, than I was at 22, 23. I think at that age, you're just not mentally equipped to go through something like that, to go from, you know, pushing hard to get to the NHL and playing hard and at the AHL level, and then you get there and all of a sudden it's just, you stop, you know? Like, I think if I were to work my way up the ranks, you know, from 22, 23 and get to the NHL at 27 now, it would just feel like such more of a sense of an accomplishment. And not that it wasn't, please don't get me wrong. It is a great accomplishment, but I think that, you know, I'm just probably where I'm at now mentally in my life and my career, I'd be much more equipped to handling that situation. I think at 22, 23, like you touched on, you do have your whole career ahead of you and you want to be playing and you want to be progressing, because when things get stagnant or stale, you know, teams kind of, you know, they look around and see what else is out there and who's progressing and who's developing. And, you know, when you kind of, I think anyways, like when you hit that wall and you're not progressing and moving forward, like, you know, teams are going to move ahead without you. And I think that was one of my fears probably in that situation, is that I wanted to keep going and keep progressing. And obviously that's, you know, but, you know, like, and it's things that are out of your control. So, you know, there is a part of you that you just have to make the best of what you got. And not saying that it was bad, obviously being in the NHL, I have some great friendships, some unbelievable memories and all that stuff. But, you know, there's only so much that you can control.
Thanks for this, Frankie. We'd love to get you on again. Maybe even talk you into coming into studio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's good, Frankie.
Yeah.
Yeah? Oh.
Absolutely, yeah. Once things clear up here, you know, a little less social distancing, and maybe we'll get up to the studio.
That when it's on the air, that's as good as a written contract.
Oh, okay,
it's going to happen. Thanks for this, pal. Really appreciate it. Frank Corrado of the Belleville Senators, and pretty open and honest about his time here in Toronto and how that went. I mean, you look at his numbers. Good God. He played 39 games in 15-16. That was the bad year. That was Babcock's first year where they were tanking for Austin Matthews. And then in 16-17, when he became so often all the talk, just two games. Just two games that season.
Yeah, I remember he sat out, right?
Healthy scratch every night.
Imagine coming for months and not playing.
Yeah.
But I will say this, it can make it worse once you have the media pressure. Because think about it. If people are pressuring you, are you going to want to do something where the media is pressuring you? No.
Well, as he said, all eyes are on him.
All eyes are on him. But at the same time, it is nice to have the recognition from the city where you're like, you know what? I'm good enough. I'm an NHLer. And everyone recognizes that.
Vote in our Twitter poll. At Scotty Mac thinks, at Mike Zigamanis, at Hugh W. Burrell. People who think sports will be back in May are hopeful or delusional. We'll check the final results, and we'll tell you about a big guest on Good Show. That's next. Bob's son, Jacob Dylan, the Wallflowers. One Headlight, Classic Hits, Key 590.
This was a great album.
Late 90s, yeah, man. Right in my wheelhouse. Good. Right in my wheelhouse. I'm like 18, 19 years old when I'm listening to this. Our poll question, and put a wrap on this. People who think pro sports will be returning by some point in May are hopeful / on the right track or completely delusional. 86% Hugh saying delusional. Yeah. 86% Ziggy saying delusional.
Pretty much stayed like that the whole day.
So you know what that tells me? 14% actually are really delusional.
Yeah.
Because if they think sports are coming back at all, I could be wrong on this, but I don't think I'm wrong. I think the United States, the numbers that are going to come out of there are positive tests and problems over the next 4 to 6 weeks. Hugh, if you had it, it would curl your hair.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I think the only league that we can count on right now is the NFL. I think the NFL is going to start on time.
And we say that with hope,
yeah,
not with definition.
No,
because
not with any degree of certainty.
We don't know where this virus is going to be at that point.
I'm hearing stuff that's coming out of even the university sports where it might be tough to start because isn't, university Canadian football, they have to get ready in August and that's in jeopardy. I mean, the guys are skating for hockey the end of August. So I just don't understand how September sports are going to start at this point if that's what they're considering. They're considering the delay of the season.
No, we'll be optimistic, but won't say anything with firm confidence until announcements are made. But it feels like we're still on the early stages of the curve of this COVID-19 virus. We are back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Good Show welcomes Big Maple James Paxton at 10:25. Have a great Monday.